point on the Transcontinental Railroad. The young woman returned and handed me a bottle of beer with a smile and a tilt of her head. Thank you. She eyed me a moment more, and then I turned back to Schaefer. Well, that should be a sight. Not really. We'll be going through the tunnel, so it'll be mostly dark as 10 feet up a bull's ass. I nodded, thinking it best if I said nothing, still wondering what kind of favor he might have in mind. I was relieved when Holland, the special agent from the railroad, joined us. Gentlemen, what are we up to? Schaefer sipped his water. I'm attempting to educate the new guy. Concerning? Just about every damn thing. With that, he pushed off the bar and moved away. I don't think you impressed him with your breadth of knowledge, deputy, said the sad-looking train dick. No, I suppose not. I gestured out the window. Have you ever wondered why all of the major cities, or what passes for major cities in southern Wyoming, are almost exactly 2 hours apart by train? Can't say that I have. They started out as water stops for when all the trains were steam. He cocked his head. I'd say Sheriff Schaefer has underestimated your deputy, Longmire. I'm careful who I share my intellect with, Mr. Holland. My eyes went back to the window. We were indeed climbing. You know about the raffle? Excuse me? The raffle, when Wyoming moved from being an Indian territory to becoming a state, they knew they needed towns every 2 hours for those water stops, so they put up a raffle to divide the state government. The towns would get their choice of the capital, the university, the prison, or the psychiatric hospital. Who won? Rawlins. He looked at me, doubtful. The prison? I nodded. First choice. The theory being that they weren't so sure how the state government or higher education thing would work out, but we'll always have prisoners here in Wyoming. He pulled at an elongated earlobe. Well, they had a point. He glanced over his shoulder. That might be one of the reasons Schaefer's not too sociable. He lives in Rawlins? No, but he's got a brother that had a short stop there before they shipped him off to Evanston. I raised an eyebrow. Maybe this had something to do with the favor Schaefer had mentioned. Holland looked around to make sure the sheriff of Albany County was well out of earshot. This brother of his, Ed, got into some trouble back when he was a kid and did a juvenile stint. When he got out, they figured he was okay, but pretty soon some co-eds started disappearing around the university in Laramie. I guess he killed a half dozen before they figured out it was him. He was an adult by that time, and they sent him to Rawlins on a life sentence. But when he killed a guard there, they stuffed him in a hole underneath the Wyoming State Insane Asylum. Black sheep, huh? He nodded. They tested him, and they say he's got an IQ of over 140. He glanced around and remained silent as another sheriff passed us holding two drinks. Arrested by his own brother. Strange, too, even with more than a couple of years between them. They look remarkably alike with the same proptosis. The bulging eye? He nodded. But in opposite eyes. John's is the left and Ed's is the right. Even though they aren't twins, there are some folks who said that was the only way you could tell the two apart. Before they lodged Ed under the insane asylum? Yeah. He nodded toward the man who now stood near Lucian and was listening to the stories. John's one tough hombre. He still goes and visits his brother every month over there. And I was on this train with him a year ago, and he invited me to go along. The man shuddered. My God, I've never been in a place like that. They slid that grate aside, and the two of them talked through a hole in the door. His face turned back to mine. I've never seen anything like that. There just aren't words for it. Ed just kept telling his brother that he was innocent, and he had to get him out of there. Unfortunate. Is that what you call it? He shook his head. They should have taken Ed out and shot him in a ditch and left the body for the turkey buzzards. Unless he really is innocent. He chuckled. Don't you know? Everybody's innocent in there. He stared at me. You're a true believer, huh? Define true believer. Someone who thinks there is an equal and all-encompassing justice? I took a sip of my beer before answering. No, I don't think there is. Certainly not after Vietnam. He studied me a few moments more. Yeah, you're a true believer, all right. You ought to get one of those phones that tell you where to go. Lucian stuffed the bowl of his pipe from the beaded tobacco pouch as I drove. I know where I'm going. He glanced around as I parked in the municipal lot. This ain't the way to the Office of Probation and Parole. I know that, too. I cut the ignition. Now, where the hell are we going? Wyoming Court of Appeals. Hell, what's being appealed? I pulled the handle and opened the door of my truck, glad to get him out before he started smoking. We're going to find out. Declining my assistance, he exited from the other side and eased the prosthetic leg to the pavement. You need to get a lower truck. I helped him around the door and closed it behind him, handing him his four-pronged cane. You seem to have a lot of ideas about what I need. He glanced around. Well, you needed to park closer, too. Uh-huh. I shook my head and guided him in the direction of the office. How about you get one of those handicapped mirror danglers? That way I can park right by the door. He didn't say anything. Or I could get one of those complimentary wheelchairs they've got inside. How would you like to kiss my ass for a big red apple and then not get it? I assisted him in stepping up on the curb. Well, I don't think I'd like that very much at all. I spotted one of the court-appointed attorneys on his way out of the building. Dick Davis? He joined us. Hey, Walt, Lucian. Where you headed? The convict had what they are calling a heart episode, so they hauled him over to Cheyenne Regional Medical. We're in a holding pattern. Lucian poked at one of the silver-haired lawyer's boots with his cane. There are a lot of folks who would contest the fact that the convict has a heart at all. Dick nodded and started past us. I've got more cases that need attention this morning, certainly ones that pay better, so I called after him. What are we supposed to do? I guess you've got to wait until the court decides when the hearing will convene. Well, I turned back to Lucian. You want to go get Lola and go to the zoo? He ignored me. No, by God. I'm going to find out what the hell is going on. I followed, figuring the least I could do would be to keep Lucian from being incarcerated himself. Ushering him through the glass doors, I got that feeling I always did when walking on the marble floors past the wood-paneled walls of the Grand Government Building, that I was some country cousin from the hinterlands, unworthy of sullying the halls of justice. We were making our way down one of those halls when we ran into the one person in Cheyenne I was hoping to avoid. Walt Longmire, you haven't been returning my emails. I looked down at the frizzy mop of chemically dyed fuchsia hair, a color approximating nothing in the natural world. Libby, I don't have a computer. She propped a fist on a hip, obscured by an extremely loud printed caftan, and swung a scarf as large as a Hudson's Bay blanket over her shoulder, her jewelry rattling like a sheep wagon. Do you have a phone? Sometimes. Libby Troon was the owner and operator of Liberty Bail Bonds and living proof that the spirit and style of the 60s were far from dead. Well, I've got some opportunities for you and that delicious Henry Standing Bear. I watched as Lucian, who hadn't paused, kept walking. We've got enough official work to keep us busy, Libby. I tried to move past her, but she stepped in my way. There's something I'd like to talk with you about. I stifled my sigh. Go ahead. Aberane Echepere. One of the patrician Basque ranchers from my county. He's, what, 100 years old? Well, almost, I guess. But there's a situation developing with his great-grandson. What kind of situation? He keeps taking him off on unscheduled trips. Unscheduled trips, like what, fishing? Now that you mention it, yes. The parents filed charges. Aberane has taken the kid to Elko, Nevada. The charges were dropped, but I've got a funny feeling on this one. I glanced down the hallway where Lucian had disappeared. Libby, if you've got something to tell me, I'd appreciate it if you just got to the point. I've seen this pattern before where they test the limits, seeing how far they can get before they finally take the child and vanish. I stuffed my hands in my pockets and looked at her. Abarane is one of the largest landowners in the county, and he's older than dirt. Where would he run off to, the Sunnydale home for assisted living? And why would he kidnap a kid in his own family? With her hands waving and a flurry of jewelry jangling, she dismissed me and continued past. I'm just warning you, Walt. I caught up with Lucian at the office of the Court of Appeals, turned the knob of the glass-paned door and swung it open, stepping inside and pulling it closed behind me. The old sheriff was standing in front of a young woman at a reception desk who looked as if she wished she were anywhere else but under Lucian's scathing gaze as he stared at her from over the piece of paper he was holding. What the hell does that mean? The young woman reached up and tapped the paper he held.
It's all right there.
Lucian turned and looked at me. Will you please tell this young woman that I know how to read? I just need to know what it means. I took the sheet and paraphrased. The prisoner's lawyers have filed for a compassionate release, petitioning the warden in Rawlins and the court to the effect that the subject is terminally ill and would benefit from obtaining aid outside of the prison system or is otherwise eligible under the relevant law. I handed the woman back the paper and turned and walked out, not trusting myself with human company at that moment. I don't remember slamming the door, but the glass exploded into the carpeted office like it had been hit with a fragmentation grenade. Waves of emotion roiling my mind, I didn't stop to look at the damage I'd done. Instead, I stalked down the hallway through a cluster of suited men, blew open the brass double doors, and stepped out into the free air. I stood there looking at the state capitol, taking deep breaths in an attempt to control the tide of emotion that was overwhelming me. Feeling someone approaching from behind, I whirled with a snarling anger that caused Lucian to step back, whereupon he stumbled and almost fell, catching himself on the railing. Luckily, there was a bench nearby, and he redirected the fall into a seat. I stood there with my fists clenched.
You ain't gonna hit me, are you?
No.
Wouldn't be the first time.
After another breath, I turned and sat beside him, finally feeling a little cooler, the angry red tide subsiding. He studied my face.
You all right?
No. He nodded and reproduced the piece of paper. Compassionate release is most often granted to inmates with terminal illnesses that cause life expectancies of less than 6 to 18 months, depending on the jurisdiction. Other allowable causes for compassionate release may be medical but non-terminal, such as incurable, debilitating mental or physical conditions that prevent inmate self-care or a combination of advanced age and irreversible age-related conditions that prevent functioning in a prison setting. He stopped, cleared his throat, and turned to look at me again.
What in the hell is that supposed to mean, anyway?
They're going to try and set him free. Chapter 4. Henry and I negotiated the second corner of the staircase, and were trying to figure out how to navigate the next. I was starting to regret not taking Alexia's nephew and his friend Coulter up on their offer.
It's not going to fit. The bear smiled and shook his head.
You said that the last time.
I shifted the weight of the thing in an attempt to relieve the pressure on my shoulder. Maybe I'm not meant to be a furniture mover.
Then you should not have had a daughter.
Hold on a second. I moved to the landing and extended the sofa out over the backyard, wedging my legs against the railing. I have to get arranged here. He patiently waited as I prepared to bear the brunt from below.
So, particularly extraordinary or compelling circumstances which could not reasonably have been foreseen by the court at the time of sentencing?
That's what the letter says.
He had a heart attack?
Episode, supposedly. I shifted to one side. Are you pulling on this thing at all? He made headway, and we turned the corner like two men in a horse suit.
All right, put it down. I need a breather.
He did as requested, and then sat on the arm nearest him. I pushed my hat back, giving the sweat in my hair a chance to dry. For years I've been coming down here to make sure this didn't happen.
Perhaps it is time to let it go.
No.
You will not entertain the thought?
No. He said nothing.
What, you're not going to argue with me?
No.
It's a moral issue. You always argue with me about moral issues.
He looked down at me from an 8-step advantage. I am tired of arguing with you about moral issues.
Well, what are we going to talk about for the rest of our lives?
He glanced around.
The weather. Hey, when are you lollygaggers going to get the job done, huh?
I looked up. Vic was sipping a glass of red wine. Lucian was hanging over the deck railing with a bourbon in one hand and Lola in the other.
Old man, if you drop my granddaughter, could you make sure she lands on the sofa? There ain't anywhere for the lady, me, and the baby to sit up here, so speed it up, will you?
With that pronouncement, he and a couple of the loves of my life disappeared. I went back to looking at Henry.
You know what happened.
Intimately.
Then you should understand that there are some sentences that can't be broken.
He stooped to pick up the sofa again.
Hey, what's the holdup down there?
I looked up to see my daughter with her own glass of red wine. Your father is wanting to have a conversation.
No, I'm not. Well, your granddaughter wants you to play the piano for her, so maybe you should get moving.
With nothing else to do to entertain myself, I sat at the Baby Grand, a 1938 Wurlitzer butterfly, so named for the twin top boards, in the corner of the parlor car and lifted the lid. The last time I'd played was in Vietnam. Hell, I wasn't even sure I still could, with my hand scarred as it was. A drunken sheriff who was leaning against the wall nearby yelled, "Play Melancholy, Baby!" Another laughed, "How about Wreck of the Old 97? I ignored them and laced my fingers together, cracking my knuckles in a fashion that the great pianist Arthur Rubinstein would have abhorred, or maybe not. I tested a few fingers on the keys. The piano was a slight bit out of tune and the action on the soundboard a little dead, but I doubted the drunken sheriffs would be able to tell the difference.
"Let me get back there with you. I can play chopsticks with the best of them."
Just for fun, I saluted Mr. Rubinstein with a little of Chopin's waltz in C-sharp minor, but that made my audience go silent, which wouldn't do. I adjusted myself on the bench and slowly began playing a train-like rhythm that changed into a boogie-woogie beat. I vamped on this and then began bringing in my left hand to follow the chord changes at 8 to the bar.
"Holy shit!"
The second drunk gestured toward my boss, who was standing nearby.
"Hey, Lucian, this boy's actually got talent."
I had just finished up with an improvised Western Star boogie when I noticed Sheriff McKay's property, standing by the doorway with that look that singers get when they want to join in but can't figure out how. I raised my hands and began snapping my fingers, and even in its inebriated state, the audience joined in. By the time I lowered my hands to the keyboard, about half the train was snapping. I overemphasized my left hand in an attempt to make up for the lack of bass and drums. I watched the smile slink onto Kim LeClerc's face as I circled around and gave her the intro again, nodding my head for her to take the impromptu stage. She moved forward and out from under George McKay's arm. Davenport and Cooley wrote the song in 1956, the first version being recorded by Little Willie John. But I first became aware of it when this chick from North Dakota picked it up, added some lyrics of her own, and emphasized the beat, making it into a monster hit back in 58. LeClerc was surprisingly good with her husky voice, and I redoubled my efforts to match her phrasing, which was slightly different from Peggy Lee's. I looked up the length of the car and noticed that even Marv Leland, peeking over the heads of the other sheriffs, was standing in the near doorway of the packed Pullman. The clerk was feeling her oats by this time, and had begun swiveling her hips, providing a percussion all her own as George McKay advanced and reached a hand out for her. "Come on, that's enough." She slipped away from him and, having moved toward the chairs that faced the windows, continued to sing like a cornered cat. "Fever in the morning, fever all through the night." McKay moved toward her again. Even after a number of the sheriffs yelled for him to clam up and sit down, he kept reaching for her, obviously upset that she was sharing her charms with the other men.
When he got close enough, he made a grab for her, but instead knocked the hat off an individual I hadn't met yet, who took exception and stood. There were words, and McKay shoved the man out of the way. I started to get up. Suddenly a hand was on my shoulder, and I turned to find Sheriff Leland sitting next to me.
"Not your fight. At least until somebody gets out a set of bongos or an accordion. God, I hate accordions."
Bo Brown, the big farmer type from Matrona County, grabbed McKay by his collar and pulled him away from the other man, pushing him into the crowded aisle where a number of other sheriffs, including Sundown Nolan and Wayne Hanna and Holland, the security man, held him still until Leclerc and I finished the song. I struck the final note, and the car erupted in a roar of applause as Kim took a bow and blew a kiss toward me. I nodded my head and gestured back to her, and she curtsied. The group of men had released McKay, and he started toward his property just as Lucian stepped forward, intercepting him. McKay loomed large over my boss, but the smaller man had lived entire lives that most men only hear about, and he stood there like a rock outcropping in a high tide. I moved to get up, but Leland stopped me again. "In case you haven't noticed, he's about twice Sheriff Connolly's size." Leland chuckled as he glanced over his shoulder at the two would-be combatants.
"Maybe, but my money would still be on Lucian. He fights dirty. Besides, this'll be a nice audition for the presidency."
I thought for a moment McKay was going to punch Sheriff Connolly, but then more words were exchanged, and McKay seemed to deflate a little. Finally, he turned, pushed some of the others out of the way, and exited through the front of the car, giving me a particularly hard look as he passed.
"Well, scoot over." Marv glanced at me, and I did as he asked. "I think the biggest crime right now would be for you to rob this train of your talent."
He placed his hand on the keyboard, softly trilling a few notes.
"Have you ever heard of Paul Wittgenstein?"
"I've heard of Ludwig Wittgenstein, the philosopher."
"His brother. Paul was the seventh child of nine. Now, the Wittgensteins were one of Vienna's most remarkable families, and were so obsessed with music that they had seven grand pianos. Paul made his debut in 1913, and was already deemed a successful pianist and promising virtuoso when he enlisted in the Austrian army."
I had a funny feeling I knew where this was going. His hand trailed up the keys, ending on a grim chord.
"A few months later, he was wounded on the Russian front and taken prisoner, where they amputated his right arm. In a Siberian prison camp, he practiced Chopin on a wooden box, improvising ways for one hand to play both melody and harmony."
Sheriff Leland began playing in a waterfall of five fingers, and I'd never witnessed anything like it.
"After the war, Wittgenstein returned home and commissioned more than a dozen pieces from some of the greatest composers of his time."
He chuckled. He wasn't particularly fond of any of them, but decided that Ravel's Piano Concerto for the Left Hand in D Major wasn't bad. He swelled into the piece, his hand flat-hatting across the keyboard and thundering the lower notes like a trip hammer. Finishing what I assumed was the first portion of the piece, he turned to look at me with his sad eyes.
"Personally, I think it's a masterpiece."
We sat there smiling at each other until we became aware of the silence and looked up once again to find the onlookers dumbstruck. I leaned his way and spoke in a low voice.
"Maybe not a highbrow crowd."
Leland immediately launched into a jazzy blues version of "This Train." Boy, howdy.
"How was your day?"
I sat on Katie's newly arrived sofa with Dog snoring at my feet and Lola snoring on my daughter's lap as the radio played in the background.
"Great."
She stared at me over the lip of her glass.
"Okay, not so great."
She put her wine down and cradled Lola's head in the crook of her arm so that she would stop snoring.
"So is this a medical release? Medical parole? Medical furlough? Humanitarian parole?"
I nudged Dog with my boot. I'll find out tomorrow morning in the judge's chambers. In these cases, the eligibility usually is a result of terminal or chronic illness.
Yep.
So he's dying.
Maybe.
I stood and walked toward the door.
Where are you going?
I just need some air. I pushed it open and stepped out onto the deck that overlooked the alley and the backyard. Carrying my tea to the balustrade, I stood there for a while, looking at the nearby park and cemetery. Vic, Henry, and Lucian had gone to bed, and since Kitty and I had occupied the new sofa